Hi, my name is Linda Hirsch. I'm a professor in the English department at the college. I am also the Writing Across the Curriculum co-coordinator, and I have been here for about 41 years, but maybe even a little bit longer because I started as an adjunct in 1973 when I was truly a woman in her very early 20s. And I got a full-time position here in 1975. And HOSOS was really one of the few CUNY campuses that was even offering full-time lines. And it was the new campus, pretty new. And because the city was in terrible financial straits, there was nobody hiring in CUNY pretty much except for HOSOS. And I'd been an adjunct here, as I said, and I was teaching ESL. And I was in the English ESL, the English department at that time housed ESL. And I got a full-time line. So I began here in 1975. And I guess I've spent not only my entire career here, but I would say that my adult life has really been at HOSOS. So it's been a kind of parallel growth of a human being, a woman, a person, a mother, and at the same time, an academic, a teacher, a scholar, an administrator, somebody who really learned to kind of grow up at the job. So really, as I said, I've been here from my youth to my not so much youth anymore. So it's my life, really. HOSOS has been my career.
But you're young.
Well, yeah, I guess. Well, you know what? I was just marveling when I walked over here listening to some of the students playing piano that, you know, I've really been very fortunate to spend my entire life with young adults. Working on a college campus is a very wonderful thing. I think it's one of the reasons why college professors don't retire as early as other people. You know, there's been a TIA CREF study about that, and they don't. And there are reasons why we don't, and that's because we're always in a really wonderful environment. An intellectual environment with young people, with students who are really just wonderful to be with and colleagues. So, yeah, I was just thinking about that as I walked over here. That it's nice to be in a place where there's a piano being played, you know, and people say, hi, professor, you know, when you walk by. And it's really nice. So,
what made you stay?
You know, it's interesting because I had some opportunities to do some other things. And I did take some time off every now and then. I worked at Children's Television Workshop for about a year and a half on a TV show called Ghostwriter. I did have a faculty exchange. That was a program that they had in the 90s, I think, where CUNY faculty were given the opportunity to spend some time on another campus as a professor. And I was at Lehman. And Lehman at that time had even said they would like to try to get me to remain at Lehman. And I have to say there's something about HOSOS. I don't know what it is. It matched my personality, I guess, obviously, if I've been here for so long. It matches who I am. It's a place that's very vibrant. It's a place where being busy is really good. I like to be busy. I like to do different things. So HOSOS had tremendous needs for people to step up and do things. And I was given the opportunity, I think, to wear a lot of different hats. I think if I'd only been teaching for 40 years, I think I might be burnt out and I might not be that happy. But in my time here, I've really been given the opportunity to found and run a lot of different projects. I ran the Writing Center for a while. I did a linked courses program. I worked with Looking Both Ways. You know,
what is that?
Looking Both Ways was a community senior college initiative sponsored by CUNY, where faculty from the community colleges and the senior colleges got together. I also did a bridging the something where it was high school faculty and college faculty. And here at HOSOS, I edited the Middle States Self-Study before we hired professionals and paid them a lot of money. I had the very challenging task in my early 30s of editing that self-study report at a very tumultuous time in the college. You know, the 70s and 80s here at HOSOS were not like they are now. I mean, it was just much more unpredictable and tumultuous and stressful, really, in many, many ways. I mean, as soon as I got here, my full-time job, the next year they threatened to close the college. I mean, I just got the job in 75. I was so happy. And I think by 76, they're already talking about this merge with Bronx Community College, and there were protests on the streets, and it was a big political furor. And I was like, oh, my God, child of the 60s, I thought I kind of put some of that politics a little bit behind me now, but there it was. And it was very, you know, very tumultuous, so it was hard. But I guess I am, HOSOS allowed me to grow. And every president that we've had here, with some exception, really encouraged me to take on different responsibilities. And so I think that made it really appealing. And so I've done different things. Students are always wonderful because, you know, they, you know, I used to have these discussions with people way back when in the 70s and 80s when people would say, oh, you know, community colleges have the weakest students and why are they even here? And I don't know if you remember, but there was a very bad period in the press where Hostos was accused of not, you know, using the writing test, which, by the way, the university itself has recently gotten rid of, basically. But okay, so we took a lot of heat for that. And it is true that any number of my students at the time, especially in the 70s and the early 80s, were not the best prepared students. But I would try to explain to people that each and every one of them was transformed by the experience of being in college. And that, I believe, is one of the greatest contributions that Hostos has made. It has provided educational opportunity. I don't want to sound like the blurb in the catalog because that sounds so rote. But from my heart and soul, I really understand that it provided opportunity and continues to, but now to a more conventional student body in some ways, for students who really had not been, would not have otherwise been given that opportunity. And each and every one of my students, whether they were ESL or developmental or came in at a higher level of English proficiency, were transformed, as I said, by that experience of talking about evolution and talking about how that jived or didn't jive with their religion and looking at literature and looking at, and it just changed all of them. It just made them more educated people. And I always would say to people, you know, don't you want your fellow citizens to be people who've had a real education? Isn't that better for all of us? And I believe that it was and it is. So it's always been. I think not so much anymore because I think, you know, community colleges have really come into their own as really viable alternatives for senior colleges, even nationally, with people choosing to go. But I think at the time in the CUNY system, when the CUNY system opened up Hostos and maybe a few other community colleges, I think we were, I know, yes, I think we were looked down upon. I know that because when I was at a meeting when the CPE first was being used, the proficiency exam, I was at a meeting with writing, of course, the curriculum coordinators from across CUNY, because I always, of course, I was the WAC coordinator, and I went to that meeting. And it was, and then at 80th Street. And I was sitting in a room with my fellow coordinators from other campuses, and the results had come out. And Hostos, it turned out, had done fairly well. And whoever was the dean at the time, I think it was Dolores Straker, she was the university dean, she was talking about the CPE and the results, and they were asking, you know, I don't know, who scored the highest, who scored the lowest. And I think everyone assumed that Hostos scored the lowest. And they said to me, you know, and I said, well, you know, Hostos did not score the lowest at all. And then one of them said, well, who did? And then I said, it must have been one of you. And that was one of my favorite lines of my career. I said, must have been one of your campuses, wasn't, and they were completely dumbstruck because I think the assumption was if anybody scored the lowest, it was us. And we didn't. Not from the very beginning. And I just never forgot. And everyone was laughing when I told them at Hostos. And I said to them, must have been one of you. And of course it was. I mean, but, you know, yes. So I think, and also because we took in students who are unconventional, untraditional students of an older age, with less, not many of our students came directly from high school, as you probably know. A lot of them had GEDs. They were not proficient in English, many of them. We had a huge ESL program, which we no longer have. So I think, yeah, I think there was a disparagement of Hostos, and that sometimes was upsetting. I won't say that it wasn't, but I don't know. I kind of knew what the students had to bring and what they had to offer, and I don't know. I thought it was wonderful to be able to work with them. I still do. So people who really are putting out there a lot of effort to come to college. You know, they're juggling family, they're juggling a lot of things, you know, financial exigencies. I mean, they're really working hard at it. And so I always admired that. And I always love Hostos graduation because I always find it very touching. I don't go all the time, but when I do go, I always find it very touching.
Yeah.
I like graduation.
So perhaps have passed away.
I've worked with so many people. So I was thinking about that question. The people that stand out most prominently for me, remember I came here, as I said, as a very young woman, very inexperienced myself. I mean, truly, I had taught a little bit. I had a master's degree in literature. I worked in publishing, and then I taught ESL at Christopher Columbus High School or something, and then I got the job here. So really, I did not have a lot of educational experience. I was 22 or something. And so a lot of people sort of took me under their wing. And so there I am in the, you know, the mid-70s, big furor. And the people that I remember are Shirley Hines, for whom, of course, the Allied Health Building across the street is, this building is named after her, the Shirley Hines Building. She was in Allied Health at the time. Paula Zajan from Early Childhood Education, who actually, when she passed away, one of her friends gave me her graduation robes. And those are the robes that I always wear when I go to Hostess graduation. I always wear Paula's, even though she went to Columbia and I went to NYU. People always say to me, I thought you went to NYU. And I always have, these are Paula's robes. So I always wear Paula's robes. And Magda Vasilov, who was also a good friend of mine at the time. And these are women who were somewhat older than me. And, of course, Diana Diaz, who was still here. I mean, she's alive and well. But these are the people that were really very formative for me and, you know, really helped me acclimate to Hostos. And they were good friends, and I think they contributed so much here. And they worked here at a time that was so difficult. And they really just had standards and principles, and I learned a lot from them about how to really cope. You know, again, you know, when I started, when I did that middle stage self-study as the editor, I think Tony Santiago was our president then. He was an interim guy who was here for a brief period. And it was very, very bad times. I think that was when they said OSOS was, you know, not doing what it was supposed to be doing. It was just very bad press. And the faculty, and I was the editor of the self-study. And I put together a draft based on what people told me, and then everyone told me it was much too positive. And I'd also been getting pressure from the president that it was much too negative, and that if we didn't get accreditation, it was going to be because of me, because I put in this negative report. And I remember I did say to him, I did manage, so even in my 30s, to say to him, that was the kind of thing my mother would say to me to make me feel guilty.
Jewish guilt.
I did say that. I really have to say, I was pretty good with that. I couldn't believe I said that to him. I said, well, now that is the kind of thing my mother would say to me. That's not fair. It's not up to me. But the point was at that meeting with the Middle State Steering Committee of my colleagues, they were really giving me a hard time. And I went in the bathroom and I cried. I was really upset because, you know, one person's telling me, you better make this more positive, and the other group is telling me, this isn't negative enough, you know, these things are really terrible here. And I remember it, I went to the bathroom and cried. And Angelo Ponte, I don't know if you remember him or know him, he was in the phys ed department at the time, and then I think he became an administrator. He went into the bathroom, was in this building, and he came into the bathroom, and he got me out of the bathroom, and he said to me, don't you ever cry again. And I said, I don't think that I ever did. After that, he said, and I always tell people when they say that I seem so confident now, we're junior colleagues, and they say, oh, you seem so positive. I say, you know, I started here like you. I was young. I didn't know how to handle pressure and how to handle myself. And I cried in the bathroom, and Angelo Ponte pulled me out. So, I mean, so, it was growth all around. But those are such stressful times, and that's another part of what I remember, all that pressure and, you know, how to make the college seem viable to people who were looking at it in a negative way. It was tough. Well, you know, Magda, first of all, there were lots of things about Magda. Magda had a very quiet presence, complete opposite of somebody like me. So people like me are always fascinated by very quiet people. Do you know what I mean? Because it's so different. And she's also a very well-dressed, very elegant kind of woman. You know, she always wore Chanel flats. And she just, but you know, no one else mentioned that, right? She wore Chanel flats all the time. And she just had a very elegant presence about her. And she also really had a very strong arts background. You know, she was a highly educated, knowledgeable person about the visual arts, the performing arts. And she made sure that that vision became a part of the curriculum here. So I think that what people remember is that, I shouldn't say what other people remember, but what I remember. Number one, she was a friend, all right? She was one of the people that I got to know on a more personal level. And, you know, she was a mentor in certain ways, but she really knew a lot. And she was always interested in trying new things. And when we started the Writing Crystal Curriculum Initiative here on our campus, which is, you know, the CUNY mandated program, she was one of the first people to want to do a writing intensive course or to work with a CUNY writing fellow. So I always saw her as somebody who was willing to do different things and to try new things. But she had a very elegant presence. And it was very, very different, you know, from anything that you saw here, I think. And as I said, she just knew so much about art and photography, the classics. And it was just so, and she, as I said, she was able to run the VPA department. I think then it was VPA. All these things have different names now. Visual Performing Arts. And she put her imprint on that. Do you know? So I think that's why people remember her. And Pat Parzik, who I believe is still alive, worked in the business department. And these were people who, in my mind, they were real perfectionists. And I'm always drawn to people like that. They do their work very thoroughly, and they want it to be correct. And my other hostess thing is that for 15 years, I was the only person who came to a meeting on time. And it took me a very long time to realize that hostess, that meetings didn't start on time. But now they do. So I've been here long enough to see, a complete transformation. I would come there and sit there, and I'd be looking around. Excuse me, is this the right room? Is this the right day? Is this the right time? And 15 or 20 minutes later, people would saunter in, and I have to tell you, I was mad because I had to run on German time, and that is right on the dot. And now I have to say that over the years, things function much more on time. You notice I wasn't late today. I'm hardly ever late.
Promise
is a virtue in my family. So I remember that. A group of us were hired in 1975. There were about seven of us, I think, in the English department. Six or seven of us all hired at the same time. And, you know, later we found out that the one male in our group was hired at a higher salary. I mean, we, you know, it was, you know, found out a lot of stuff. But so we were a group, you know, a group of friends. And I don't think any of us had our doctorates at the time. So then I had to went back to grad. No, because I was hired as a lecturer. Turned out I could have been hired as an instructor, which would have made a big difference, but that was one of the discrimination things that we filed. But that's another story. But then I got my PhD because then, of course, I realized that if I was going to pursue an academic path, a career, that that would be what you need. So that's what I did. But I think all of us, then, most of us in that group, not all, but many of us went on to get our doctorates.
What is your doctorate about?
My doctorate is in English education with a minor in linguistics. So it really made me, it fit in lots of things here in the English department. As I said, it enabled me to teach. My master's was in English literature. My PhD was in English ed, which is more like rhetoric and composition. And then I had the minor in linguistics. So it really fit.
Where did you do your doctorate?
NYU.
What, NYU.
NYU. And I did my master's in Stony Brook. And I went to City College. I'm a New York City girl. I went to public school in New York City. I went to PS 189 and Junior High School 52 in Washington Heights and Inwood. I went to Bronx High School of Science for high school. I went to City College for college. And then I went to Stony Brook, which is also a state school, for my master's. And then I went to NYU for my PhD. You know, but the college has always been an anchor in the community. So even when it was just the building across the street, you know, what is, you know, now the tire factory building. This building came online, the 500 building came up much later, actually. It wasn't one of our first buildings. And then we had some buildings near Lincoln Hospital and over on that end, a few. But the campus was always an anchor in the community. And I think it helped some small businesses like restaurants and a candy store, you know, because they, you know, the college community was a presence at night, and it made it safer, I think. I mean, I think it's always been an anchor in some way. Now, of course, it's a big player because it's a big cultural institution with a huge continuing ed pro. You know, I mean, all these things that make it so important in the Bronx. I actually do, and I'm always shocked at people who do not. I went to a conference at one time, and I was sitting with a group of people that I'd never met in my life. And they were all talking about various places they were born, and then where they ultimately moved to. And, you know, they all were born somewhere and moved somewhere else. And then they came to me. And I said, I was born in New York City, and I still live there. And two of them acted really surprised. They said, oh, really? And then I said, well, if you were born in New York City, why would you leave New York City? And then another woman from the group said, she's right. Why would you leave New York City? And I guess that's how I feel. Now, my son is not a city person. He finds it much too intense, but not me. I go to the theater all the time. I go to the museums. Even when my parents were immigrant parents without a lot, they always took us to city things.
Where are they from?
Germany. My mother is a Holocaust survivor, and my father came here earlier. He was in the American Army in the 30s, but my mother came in 1941. But, you know, they always took us to the Thanksgiving Day Parade and to the Empire State Building and, you know, to the museums. You know, they always did that stuff with us. So I feel very comfortable in the city. I love it. And that's what I wanted for my students. And when we just did our new first-year seminar, one of the things that we built, you know, it's called What Makes a City Great, and it's about New York City. And one of the best things that we did, I think what we like so much about it, is we take our students to places in the city that they don't go to. I remember Carmen Marin, this is coming back to me now, who also passed away very, very young. She taught Intro to the Humanities, and she taught her section in both English and in Spanish. And we wrote an article about her and her section, about what was different about the Spanish section and the English section, because ostensibly it was the same class. But what was different was that the students in her Spanish section felt very uncomfortable about going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, about going into neighborhoods outside of their own, and they felt that they didn't belong there. And I remember being very conscious of that and thinking, you know, that's really a terrible thing, that our students should not feel that they can't go to MoMA or they can't go to the Metropolitan Museum, that they don't belong there. They do. They have every right to be there as anybody else. So in this first-year seminar that we have, we expose our students. We decided not to focus it only on the Bronx, which is the capstone course. We flipped it, and we decided, let's start with the bigger city and let them know about the offerings that New York has and what the bridges and the tunnels are like.
And that they're welcome,
and we take them. And I took my students 1 year to the Museum of the City of New York on a crazy rainy day. We had this trip scheduled, and when Professor Hirsch says we're going to the Museum of the City of New York, they're lucky it wasn't Hurricane Sandy. We're going. So I take them, and I really felt terrible because it was starting to pour, and there was this big walk. Someone had told me that, I think Yoel Rodriguez had told me it's like a block from the subway. That was ridiculous. It was like 3 or 4 long blocks from the subway to the museum. I was ready to strangle him. And my students are like little wet rags, and they are so good-humored about this. I treated them all to hot cocoa at the end of the exhibit that we saw there, and they said it was really good hot cocoa. I said to them, it should be. It's very good.
After this, yes.
And they were so terrific. But the fact that later on in their journals, because they all had to keep a journal for the class, one of them wrote about how wonderful it was taking this trip and seeing this exhibit. And then they said, we went with Professor Hirsch, she's very determined. So our students are really terrific. They're not spoiled. Mm-hmm. And they really are so open to experiences that are new and different that it's great.
But you are determined.
I'm determined.
You were a professor and a mother.
That's what was so funny when they wrote that she's determined. All my friends here laughed so hard. They said, well, they nailed you in that class. Professor Hirsch is determined. Of course it was right on. It was so funny. That's what was so funny about it, because of course it was right. Only I would say, we're going. We made up our minds, we're going. And but the point to me was that they were so great about it. They, you know, as I said, they didn't complain. They didn't say to me, what are you out of your mind? I mean, they said it was a great experience. We had fun. And of course, I told you I treated them to that hot cocoa because I felt so bad. But we did have a good time. But again, I wanted them and we wanted them and want them to see other things that the city has to offer. Mm-hmm. To know, because, you know, now education is so much about picking your career. Right. And that's a change at Hostos, as in everywhere else, too. So, you know, I'm chairing a new committee now at Hostos on the Associate in Arts degree. and it's with faculty from across a variety of disciplines. And we're looking at how we teach the liberal arts here, how we can make them more important to students, what their role is, because really without a strong liberal arts education, what I was saying about the students in the early days benefiting so much from being at Hostos, a lot of that had to do with their exposure to thinking in the liberal arts, taking art courses, taking, you know, sociology, taking things that expose them to different ways of thinking about the world. If we just funnel our students, and this is a national issue, I think, if we just funnel our students into a career, because college is so expensive, and then it's really not the same education for them. So I'm hoping, you know, you need to do both, of course. You want to be able to get a job. I understand that. But it's the balance. Do you want working for you? I want someone working for me who can really think about things and knows something and has some kind of real education, you know, has read things. So that's what we try to do, certainly in English and certainly the work that I do here. So it's rewarding for me. So.
And well, there's two things you mentioned, but one thing I want to go back to, but you talked about, how did you start EdCast?
How did I start what?
EdCast.
Oh, EdCast. Oh,
EdCast. And why?
Okay. Oh, all right. EdCast was born out of my own experience. Okay. So here I'm a young mother and I have a son who I'm looking at schools and I'm visiting lots of schools, public schools, private schools, everything. And I kind of know a little bit about what I'm looking for because I know about literacy. I mean, that's my major. I mean, that's what I do, how children learn how to read and write, how adults learn how to read and write. But my friends are constantly asking me questions about what am I looking for? What should they look for? So this is in the early 80s, I guess. No, the late 80s, because my son is born in 1986. So let's go to the mid to late 80s. Pre-K, all those things. And I guess I sort of had an epiphany that if my friends, who are very well-educated people, are walking into schools and not knowing what to look at, Saul, and not knowing what makes a good school, how does anybody, any parent, less privileged, less experienced with education, know what to look for? And it dawned on me that how could they know? Don't people need some help? And my friends are constantly asking me. So again, I had the idea. I always like to do different things, too. That's what I do. I thought it would be great to have a radio program where maybe people could call in and ask questions, and I could help answer them, and I could have some other experts on periodically to talk about education and help answer parent questions. So I mentioned it to a friend of mine who works at Lima College, and he told me about Gary Axelbank, who had a show called Bronx Talk that was on BronxNet TV. And he said, you know, Gary, it's a TV show, but he takes questions from callers. Maybe he would let you just watch his show. So I thought, great, you know, so we contacted him and he said, sure, if I wanted to come down and watch, that'd be fine. So at the end of his show, he came out and I thanked him and he asked me why I was there. And I told him that I had this idea that maybe I would do something on education. And he said to me, well, that sounds like a great idea. Would you like to try that on my show? And I thought, well, whoa, okay, sure. And I would produce it myself, which I've never done before, you know. And I would get my own guests and my own questions and everything. But I would have like maybe once a week, I think it was once a week, a 20-minute segment. I think he had like a two-hour show or something, from 10 to noon or 10 to 11:30. He had time to fill, believe me. He had a, you know, big time span. And he gave me that opportunity. So I did that for a while. And taught me, you know, lots of things, you know, how to get guests, how to write questions. And Gary sat in with me most of the time. And he was a participant as well. And he was, I really learned a lot from him. And then I used to joke that, I aspired to CUNY TV the way comedians aspired to the Carson show. And everyone would laugh. And this is my big goal in life, CUNY TV. So my friend at Lehman, who ran the Multimedia Center at the time, said, look, you know, we could send CUNY a pilot, and they'll either say yes or they'll say no. So if you want to try it and expand on what you've been doing with Gary and really do a bigger thing where you can cover more issues, let's try it. And like you said, if they don't like it, they'll just say thanks, but no thanks is no big deal. So I thought, okay. So we sent them a pilot, and they said, good idea. So that's how it started. Yeah, and really was born out of my own recognition that when it comes to education, it's a lot of politics, it's a lot of hype, and there's a real dearth of information that could help a parent or a family or a caregiver that has to make a sound decision. And what could be more important than making a decision about the education of your children? And that's one of the areas in which we know, you know, and now, of course, you know, the tension between charter schools and traditional public schools and are they good or aren't they? We always, you know, we try to have people come on to talk about those things in an unpolitical, you know, in a way that's informative. But, you know, of course, it's hard to stay away from politics in general. So it's been really interesting to me, too, because, again, if you're going to be in one place for a long time, if you don't grow yourself, then I don't think you have as much to offer other people. So if I never grew as a teacher or as a scholar, if I don't keep myself abreast of new things in my field, let's say, then what good as a teacher am I? I mean, I'm no good at all. So I always go to conferences. I present at conferences. But I go even when I'm not presenting because I want to hear, you know, what's out there. Mm-hmm. Still read the journals in my field. You know, I still do that stuff. Because, you know, if you don't, then you're just treading water, right? Then you're not, you know, you're not doing a good job. Yeah. So I try. You know, Hostos is special because for me, on a personal level, it is where I grew up. I mean, it really is where I've spent maybe more time than any place else. I mean, look, I'm here a lot. And so it is who I am in many ways. And it's made me very aware of culture and cultural differences and yet cultural acceptances. So it's not always an easy place to be in for somebody like me. So I think, but in the end, I've always felt like very accepted and that this really is like a family to me. And I know people use that. It's such a cliche and it sounds so, you know, family, you know, and, you know, people always say that, and what does that really mean? You know, are they giving blood for you? I don't know. I bet you hear they might. I swear. Do you know what I mean? I really feel like people really come together when we've had our differences. I've been on the opposite side of differences here. But I think that Hostos is a place of intellectual growth and artistic growth. And I think it's always taken its mission and its responsibility very seriously. And I guess I feel very fortunate to have been a part of that.